It introduces us to a form of Aleut art that we didn't really know existed until now.
An important archaeological find from the Aleutians. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the North Slope Borough Attorney responds to the investigation of bribery and mismanagement in the recent borough election.
The results will have an enormous impact on our lives up here, but that's just something that you go through.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
A stone that was used as a garden ornament for the last 50 years may turn out to be one of the most important archaeological finds in Aleutian history, offering new insights into Onungan culture. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
The stone is 2.5 feet wide by 3 feet tall and weighs more than 250 pounds. Lifting it requires a forklift, but the elaborate etchings that cover one entire side are delicate. Centuries, if not millennia, of erosion have smoothed any sharp edges, leaving a maze of ridges and valleys. The symbols are hard to interpret. Even the woman who owned the stone for more than 50 years says she can't pick out much more than the fact that the outline looks like a seal.
At first, we thought it looked like a fish, but because of the nostrils, we decided that it was a seal. But there are other carvings on the back of it that were just seem to be random designs.
That's Betsy Burr. She and her mother purchased the stone at an antique store in Berkeley, California, sometime in the late 50s or early 60s. All she knew about it until recently was the story the antique dealer told them, which was that an airman stationed in the Aleutians during World War II had found it on a beach and shipped it south on a cargo plane.
He intended to sell it and make a lot of money for it because he thought it must be very valuable, but his time was up. He couldn't find a buyer.
Burr's mother purchased it for $25 and installed it in their garden. The stone moved around with the family up until 2001 when Burr's father passed away and Burr inherited the stone. She now lives in New Jersey and she didn't want to have the stone shipped from California, so she gave it to her brother-in-law who put it in storage for almost a decade. Then in 2009, she decided it was time to sell. Like the airmen, she was hoping the stone would be valuable.
It was a big surprise to us to find out that the rock didn't belong to us, because we did think that it belonged to us. We didn't know that it belonged to the federal government.
It turns out that if the antique dealer's story is true, the stone probably does belong to the government. The airman was likely stationed on Shemya Island, which was used as an Air Force base during World War II. That means anything taken from the island during that period also belongs to the government. So Burr gave the stone to the Museum of the North in Fairbanks. Researchers there are trying to independently verify its origins by comparing its composition to rocks on Shemya. But no other rock art has ever been reported on Shemya. In fact, petroglyphs have only been found once before in the Aleutians, on Agatu Island, about 30 miles to the southwest. Archaeologist Allison McLean says that makes figuring out where the stone came from more urgent.
It could change our interpretations of Aleut art. It introduces us to a form of Aleut art that we didn't really know existed until now, other than the petroglyphs on Agatu, which are radically different in some ways from the art that's carved into the steel stone.
McLean was contracted by the museum to do an analysis of the stone's inscriptions. She says the symbols Burr had trouble interpreting are what make the stone interesting.
Not free and clear. I mean, if you go to Kodiak and you look at the petroglyphs, it's very clear. Oh, there's a face, there's a canoe, there's a whale. It's not the case with the seal stone, which is part of why I think it's so fascinating.
McLean says she can pick out a seal, birds, a whale, several human faces, a phallus, female genitalia, and potentially a sea monster. She's trying to match the petroglyphs to other Unungan art to figure out when and where the stone was carved. She's also holding out hope that someone will come forward with more information.
Sooner or later, someone will remember, oh yeah, this is what I did with that artifact after I took it off this Aleutian Island I was stationed on during World War II.
If the stone does end up being from the Aleutians, McLean sees it as a promising sign that there might be more petroglyphs out there waiting to be found. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
A hearing will be held on Monday in Barrow to investigate allegations of vote count discrepancies, bribery, and other charges in the runoff election between North Slope Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower and her opponent, George Amawak. Yesterday, we aired an interview with Amawak's attorney. Today, we have a response from the North Slope Borough. Ethel Putkatuk is the attorney for the borough. She says the outcome of the investigation will have an enormous impact on the North Slope.
I can't talk to you about what we found in terms of the allegations made against the borough clerk. I think it's all premature. Mr. Amawak and Mr. McKeever know full well that there is a full pre-hearing scheduled for Monday at 2 o'clock.
And they're also alleging bribery in the form of vote buying. They've got an affidavit by a gentleman who said that he'd been offered money to vote for Mayor Brower. In your work in looking into these allegations, what have you found in that respect beyond this one affidavit that they have?
That's another matter that's still undergoing investigation. There have been allegations made that we were not going to investigate it, and those allegations were made without knowledge of what if anything the North Slope Borough was doing with respect to that aspect of the investigation. I asked for the assistance of the police chief to see what they could find, to see what we could turn over to the district attorney's office or the appropriate people. And there have been already claims made that the North Slope Borough was not going to do this, and letters sent to the attorney general's office, implying that, you know, this matter was being left alone by the North Slope Borough, the North Slope Borough, which was entirely untrue.
The charges that they've presented that there were inconsistencies in the official number of ballots versus votes that came back in, also allegations about improper date notification for absentee ballots. What, when you look at the documentation here, what are you finding with the numbers being in flux with these votes?
Well, number one, just in terms of the numbers shifting, to the extent that the disclosures that were made might reflect the actual counts as the vote counting was proceeding. I don't have any problem with that. The other thing with the shifting numbers is another matter that we will disclose on Monday.
And as an attorney, when you look at the body of evidence that you're collecting and the documents that have been presented by Mr. Amawak and his attorney, do you think it was premature to certify the election?
There are two ways of looking at the certification. And this is just from my personal perspective. It does not reflect the borough mayor's or the North Slope Borough's position. Number one, do you certify knowing full well that the election contest could change the result? I didn't see anything wrong with that, because the option was to keep the government in limbo. Or do you not certify, and by that refusal to certify, signal to the public, and especially to the borough clerk's office, that the borough assembly distrusted the entire election process? They made a really, really difficult choice. They chose to certify, knowing full well that depending on the results of the election contest, that we might have to, number one, do a recount, or number two, run another election, depending on what the findings are and what the results are that we present to the North Slope Borough Assembly.
Ethel Potkatuk is the attorney for the North Slope Borough. Monday's hearing will be held in the Borough Assembly Room and broadcast live on KBRW. A 19-year-old Anchorage woman has pleaded not guilty to charges she killed a pedestrian in a hit-and-run accident on Easter, possibly while texting. Ashley Bashore entered her plea Thursday. She was charged by a grand jury with criminally negligent homicide, leaving the scene of an injury accident and tampering with physical evidence. The April 24th crash killed 28-year-old Hubert Tunichuk. He and his companions were crossing the Tudor Road overpass above the New Seward Highway on foot at the time. Police say their investigation indicates she was texting shortly before or during the accident. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Homer kids take to the stage for some holiday cheer.
Why was the bee's hair sticky?
Why? He used a honeycomb.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The advocacy group One Anchorage turned over more than 13,000 signatures to Anchorage's municipal clerk today. One Anchorage wants to put an equal rights initiative on the next city ballot, which will ensure the same rights for gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals that are now guaranteed for women and minorities. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
We're ready to go. Do you have these in a specific order?
One Anchorage representatives, led by Chair Trevor Storrs, briefly stopped by the Anchorage City Clerk's office with a box load of signed papers. The group is submitting the signatures so it can get an equal rights initiative placed on the city ballot next April. Storrs says today marks a milestone for Anchorage.
Anchorage voters signed up to support putting this initiative on the ballot. That's more than twice the number of signatures required. The diverse support for this campaign is amazing and indicates that Anchorage is ready to take a stand to treat everybody equally and fairly.
One Anchorage volunteers collected the signatures from all areas of town, Storrs said. At least 5,871 of them must be Anchorage registered voters. Storrs said One Anchorage volunteers did not face any intimidation while collecting the signatures starting in September. The organization had 90 days to collect the signatures for the ballot initiative. Among One Anchorage supporters, former Alaska Governor Tony Knowles and former state legislator Arlis Sturgiluski.
I think it's needed. I think the time is there. I think the enthusiasm of the community is there. So I'm delighted to see this happening.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan said through a spokesperson that he believes a ballot initiative is appropriate in that it allows all citizens to weigh in on the subject. Sullivan vetoed a similar equal rights ordinance for gays in 2009, even though the ordinance was approved by the Anchorage Municipal Assembly. Sullivan said at the time that there was not enough evidence that the ordinance was necessary. Storrs said that gay and transgender people continue to report discrimination in jobs and housing, making the inclusion of gays in the city equal rights code a necessity.
The people of this community now have an opportunity to vote in April, which is really important to address and look at fair and equal treatment by our city laws for our gay and transgender neighbors. I wish we lived in a world where everyone was automatically treated the same, regardless of whether or not we agreed or disagreed with who they are as people. But the reality is a person who works hard and does a good job can be fired simply because they are gay.
The earlier attempt at a gay equal rights ordinance was opposed by some Christian church groups. However, the current initiative is supported by a number of churches banding together as Christians for Equality. Reverend Michael Burke represents that group.
This is a wonderful new day in Anchorage, and we look forward to a day when our friends and neighbors are free to work hard play by the rules and not be subject to any unfair discrimination. And there's really nothing more American and Alaskan than that.
The ballot initiative would amend the Anchorage Municipal Code to add sexual orientation and transgender identity to those now legally protected by city code against discrimination in jobs, housing, or financial dealings. Municipal Clerk Barbara Gruenstein said the proposed initiative has already received legal review, and if the required number of signatures is valid, it will be on the April 3, 2012 ballot. It could be about a week before the signatures are validated. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Day two of a hearing got underway today in Juneau for a Coast Guard officer facing charges related to a helicopter crash off the coast of Washington State last year. As KTOO's Matt Miller reports, those who investigated the flight of Coast Guard 6017 said yesterday that the crash's only survivor shirked his duties as co-pilot of the aircraft. His defense says that's not true.
Lieutenant Lance Leone was the co-pilot of a Coast Guard H-60 helicopter that was being flown from Astoria, Oregon, to its new assigned station in Sitka in July of last year. It crashed after striking power lines near La Push, Washington. Leone was the only survivor. Lieutenant Sean Kruger, the pilot, and aviation maintenance technicians Adam Hoke and Brett Banks were killed. On Wednesday, a civilian helicopter pilot who witnessed an H-60 flying near Long Beach, Washington, testified that it appeared to be flying about 150 feet off the ground and as fast as 150 knots on the day of the crash. But under cross-examination, she admitted that she had sent an email to a Coast Guard officer days after the crash that indicated the chopper wasn't flying quite that low and quite that fast. A Coast Guard accident investigator testified that Leone's helicopter traveled at an altitude that was too low and violated regulations for flight through two wildlife refuges. Wednesday, Leone's defense counsel, government counsel, and the hearing's investigating officer listened to cockpit voice recorder tapes behind closed doors. The Article 32 hearing is much like a grand jury proceeding or preliminary hearing in civilian criminal court, but the accused has the ability to refute the government's evidence or cross-examine witnesses. Proceedings are now expected to last into Friday before the hearing's investigating officer drafts a set of recommendations. He could call for dismissal of the charges, administrative or internal discipline, or a general court-martial. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The Army Corps of Engineers is taking public comment on a draft environmental impact statement for ExxonMobil's proposed development of oil and gas at Point Thompson on the North Slope. Point Thompson is east of Prudhoe Bay and is estimated to contain a quarter of all known North Slope gas. ExxonMobil proposes pumping natural gas liquids through a 23-mile pipeline to the Badami field and through existing feeder pipe to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Army Corps Point Thompson project manager Hank Bai says there are four development alternatives in the draft EIS, including ExxonMobil's preferred plan.
They propose three onshore, right along the coastline, gravel pads, and then there's a large airstrip. It's about a mile long, and then there's a large gravel mine and a stockpile area. And between these pads, they propose gathering pipelines, gravel roads connecting them, and some facilities along the coast to handle barges.
Overflights are considered a wildlife impact. Bai says the three action proposals are designed to allow ExxonMobil to operate with varying environmental effects. The proposed development area is 2 miles from the border of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Bai says it has wilderness quality and there are wildlife issues.
The listing of the polar bear as threatened species and then the critical habitat area that was designated within 5 miles of the Beaufort Sea coastline, and the barrier islands where the sows will den.
Bai says two caribou herds and a number of birds, including some listed species, also use the area. Point Thompson is presumed to hold oil as well as gas. 21 exploratory wells have been drilled in the field. The state is joining a lawsuit challenging National Park Service authority to regulate navigable waters in Alaska. The governor's office has directed the Department of Law to join a suit filed by Anchorage resident John Sturgeon. Sturgeon used a hovercraft to moose hunt in the Yukon-Charlie River's National Preserve until 2007, when he was told the vessel was not permitted in the preserve. Sturgeon filed a civil suit this fall challenging the Park Service's authority. The state owns all submerged lands in Alaska, but the National Park Service maintains it has the right to enforce regulations on waters flowing through parks. Federal law, including the U.S. Constitution and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, mandate state ownership and management, but there are also provisions interpreted to allow some federal regulation. Similar issues are at play in another case the state intervened in. Central resident Jim Wild challenged charges stemming from a confrontation with Yukon Charlie Rangers this last year. Wild is awaiting sentencing after being found guilty in October of interfering with the Park Service, violating a lawful federal order, and operating an unregistered boat. An appeal challenging the agency's authority on state navigable waters is likely in the Wild case.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Alaska was recently the first state in the U.S. to allow texting with a HIPAA-compliant mobile application statewide. Jim Jordan is the executive director of the Alaska State Medical Association, which recently endorsed use of the smartphone app DocBookMD. Jordan says it will improve service, especially when it comes to referrals between the bush and urban centers.
Another really neat feature, which I saw a couple of weeks ago during a demonstration of DocBookMD was in that process of dealing with referral. It also links directly into Google Maps and comes up with directions as to how to get to that particular physician's location.
DocBookMD can be used with mobile devices such as iPhones, iPads, iPod Touches, and Android phones. ASMA endorsed the mobile app in July. The Medical Exchange of California, a professional liability insurer in Alaska, is providing the app free of charge to ASMA members. The application is encrypted to protect confidential information. Before approval of DocBookMD app, doctors who texted information about patients were in violation of HIPAA regulations and could be charged with a felony offense. Jordan says he expects doctors to begin using the app by the new year. That's also when broadband internet service needed to operate the mobile devices used to access the app should begin arriving in Southwest and Western Alaska communities. The Mariner Theater at Homer High School was filled nearly to capacity Tuesday afternoon as children from Paul Banks Elementary School filed onto the stage to prepare for their annual Christmas program. KBBI's Aaron Selbig was there and captured these sounds.
This year's Paul Banks production is the work of musical director and kid wrangler Tina Moore, as her kindergarten, first, and second grade thespians filed onto the big stage in front of a packed house. Some of them waved excitedly and shouted, "Mama!" when they saw their parents in the audience. The parents, meanwhile, were busy waving back while snapping pictures and or video with their digital cameras and iPhones. This year's presentation, A Bug's Christmas, was reflected in the colorful, imaginative, and yes, super cute costumes of the students. Some of the kids were butterflies, some were playing ladybugs, and still others were dressed as bumblebees.
Why was the bee's hair sticky?
Why? He used a honeycomb.
And why not start things off with a joke or two?
Why did the boy throw butter out the window?
Why?
He wanted to see a butterfly.
Huh? You gotta admit, that is quality material. But as A Bug's Christmas got underway and the plot began to unfold, it became quickly apparent that all was not fun and games.
Oh no, something bad has happened. The termites have come uninvited.
Now hold on, everybody. Let's not get too excited. But they chewed up all the decorations, even the lights.
And now the evergreen is dark and it's almost Christmas night.
Here come the termites, like it or not, lined up all in a row.
They already wrecked the Christmas tree and now they'll steal a show.
That's right, termites. Ugly brown termites, all of them played by boys, if you can believe that, have eaten the Christmas lights, all of the decorations, and even the tree. The other 200 or so bugs were not happy about it either, especially the queen bee.
What's going on? What happened here? Why is the evergreen not lit? I'm the queen bee after all and ready to throw a fit.
But those pesky, bothersome termites simply would not go away and leave Christmas to the nice bugs.
We don't need any cookies or fruit cake with our lunch. Just give us each a two-by-four or take a bed to lunch. We might be in your Christmas tree or maybe in your walls. And we'll just keep on eating while you keep digging the halls.
But then, in a stunning plot twist that no one in the audience saw coming, well, I didn't anyway, the bugs had a change of heart and decided to let the termites stick around for Christmas.
Wait a minute, not so fast. We want you all to stay. No one should be left out on this special holiday. Amen.
Really? Really? Do you mean it? Do we really get to stay?
Christmas is a time for sharing, for handshakes and for hugs.
And don't forget to be extra nice to all us little bugs.
Yeah, don't forget to be extra nice to all us little bugs.
And how else to end a spirit-rousing performance like this one? But with a stirring rendition of that timeless holiday classic song, The 12 Bugs of Christmas. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If we had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Stacia Eaton in Dillingham, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
AT&T. Rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.